Hi, welcome to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today we're talking with our guest, Robert Audi, and asking why is religious commitment important? Religion is complicated. Analyzing it requires skills from virtually every discipline. Yet even some of the most sophisticated people have a tendency to think about it in the most simplistic ways. They dismiss it as fiction gone awry, or worse, an indication of mental defect. Let me begin by telling you a story. As the advisor to the University of North Dakota's Jewish Student Organization, it often falls on me to remind other faculty when the high holidays are coming. These are the most important days of the Jewish calendar, and Jewish students always miss class because of them. Yet when I email out a request that faculty not schedule tests on these days, and that they remind their TAs that students are legally excused to worship, I frequently get backlash. If I had to cancel class for every religious holiday, I'd never have class, one person wrote. Another person compared Judaism to worshiping Thor, and several others remarked that since religion is a private matter, they shouldn't know why students are absent. Missing class is missing class, they said, and no excuses are permitted. But the most vitriolic response came from a sociologist who asked why he should, quote, grant special favors to those who happen to believe in the supernatural, unquote. Now, this was a sociologist. A person who studies group behavior for a living. He researches how institutions manage people and how collective power belittles or cultivates individual agency. Each of these things is directly related to religion, and I found his comment so astonishing that I responded with, "If you really believe that religion is about people who happen to believe in the supernatural, then the sociology police are going to break down your door and take away your PhD." Naturally, he responded with silence. He knew that he had betrayed his discipline by providing, frankly, a dumbass description of one of the longest-running and most influential sociological forces in human history. He also knew that belief in the supernatural is only one tiny part of religion. Religion is a human phenomenon that helps define relationships between governments and the governed, allies and enemies, families and neighbors, the genders, economic classes. It affects how we think about technology and medicine, science, literature and art, well, everything. As I said, religion is complicated. Now, a lot was going on the faculty listserv when the sociologist wrote that comment. Faculty were behaving badly because they could. And many professors, especially men, like having a good public argument. It's their sport of choice. People were also vying for campus power while feeling sheltered by the unreality of email. No one ever says these kinds of things to my face. And there was also, among these professors, an unstated competition to see who could be the best leftist. Since Marx, Nietzsche, and Foucault all denigrated religion, many self-proclaimed critics of the modern age think that they get to disrespect it in any way they want. And finally, anti-Semitism played a small role in the discussion. In short, those who thought they were declaring their independence from religion were actually replaying its history. Power competition and self-image converged to enforce an orthodoxy used to shame the person who stood out as different. Now, these are, of course, the most negative and divisive aspects of religion. There are countless positives, too, from suggesting life's meanings to supplying the world with its most influential art and music. This is why we need a philosophy of religion, to be able to sort out all the ideas that surround religion while identifying what exactly religion is, what it does, and when it is relevant. This will involve other disciplines, anthropology, sociology, psychology, economics, aesthetics, but those areas won't bring out what philosophers call the normative aspects of religious ideas. Normativity involves saying what things are good or bad, how we should value them, and how they ought to be. Philosophy doesn't just describe, it prescribes too. And before we accept the prescriptions of individual religions, we need to examine who and what religion should have authority over so that we can help them evolve and, if necessary, either limit or expand their influence. On today's episode, we're going to start doing just this. We're going to examine religion from a normative perspective, with special attention to what it means to commit to religious practices. In other words, we're not going to look at the truth behind the supernatural aspects that my colleague dismissed. We're not going to ask whether God or angels exist, for example. We're going to examine the philosophical structures that make religious behaviors defensible or not, and consider a way of evaluating the reasons that people give for acting how they do. We're going to ask how religion relates to reason and rationality, and how it connects to the larger social, political, and ethical realms that define when and where the religion is allowed to assert itself. Now, this is a tall order, but discussing religion always is. It is personal, political, and amorphous. If it weren't, it wouldn't be so important. And if it weren't so important, it wouldn't be so hard to talk about. And now our guest. Robert Audi is the John A. O'Brien Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. He's the author and editor of more than 20 books and hundreds of articles on ethics, political philosophy, epistemology, philosophy of mind, and philosophy of religion. Robert, welcome to Why.
Thanks. Glad to be talking with you.
We're pre-recording the show, so we can't take your questions live, but if you like, you can join our listeners in our chat room at whyradioshow.org. So, Robert, when I was thinking about starting the show, I had all these different questions in mind, but I got really overwhelmed really quickly. This is such a big conversation. How do we have a conversation like this? How do we start thinking about religion from a philosophical angle?
Well, there are definitional questions, and there are questions about the role of religion in citizenship, the role of it in the lives of the religious. You mentioned connections with the aesthetic. There are connections, of course, with the emotional, the interpersonal, the political.
Is there a place that you like to start personally? Is there something that you think gives you the best inroad, or is it just whatever problem happens to be in front of your eyes at any given moment?
Well, your own introduction puts one in mind of the importance of rejecting stereotypes. So one stereotype is that religion is necessarily theistic. And of course, there are many conceptions of God among theistic religions. Even if theism is the most important element in the great religions, it's not the only element. And when enough other elements are present, we can talk about a non-theistic religion. So some of the Eastern religions would qualify.
So now this is actually a real debate sort of tangentially when people talk about whether America is a Christian nation or not. Some people say it's theistic. Some people say, no, the founders are deistic. What's the difference between a theistic religion and a deistic religion or other kinds of religion? And how to and does that change what a religion can or can't do if they have different notions of God at their center?
It's normal for a religion to involve a worldview. Characteristically, there will be supernatural elements, but there don't absolutely have to be. And I ought to say there are other stereotypes. I've myself worked hard against the stereotypic view that a religious commitment must be lacking in rationality. Another stereotype is the view that religiously inspired ethics can't be grounded in a way that makes it appealing to and communicable to other people outside the tradition.
So this is already, right, putting into question some people's habitual ideas about religion, that religion doesn't have anything to do with reason, or that religion is non-communicable experience, that there's this mysticism involved. So this is a historical, not a philosophical question, but is this notion that religion is unreasonable or even irrational, is that a local belief? Is that an American political belief? Or is that something that religious philosophers of religion and religious scholars have fought back and forth with through most of human history?
Well, skepticism is very old, and there has been skepticism about religious views for centuries. It goes back even to ancient times. So skepticism is something that is always there and must be responded to. Philosophers take it very seriously, and rightly so.
And when you say skepticism, do you mean the very basic suspicion we have when someone tells us that something is true? Or do you mean a deeper, sort of more like David Hume skepticism that is going to really challenge all of the foundations of knowledge and therefore really make people question their whole worldview?
Well, I had in mind chiefly skepticism about religious claims. There's, of course, general skepticism, and philosophers deal with that as well as with skepticism about religious commitments. But there are people who are not temperamentally skeptical and are very confident, perhaps too easily confident, about scientific claims, who are highly skeptical about any religious ones.
Can you give me an example of such a thing?
Well, I think a popular example would come from the idea that when a drug is tested, there can be scientific proof of its efficacy. Proof is a very strong word. It's been claimed for theism, but many philosophers of religion think that there are evidences that are significant that fall short of proof. And in general, in the philosophy of science, arguments for a hypothesis are regarded as inductive, in a sense implying that they give degrees of probability and do not provide grounds for absolute certainty.
Right. So this question of proof, right, this is a deep issue in life and philosophy. In religion, there were different philosophers who have purported to prove the existence of God. But when we talk about proof in general, we tend not to mean absolute 100% certainty, indubitableness. You can't imagine doubt at all. Instead, what we mean is this thing that you're talking about, probability. So are there religions that are satisfied with the idea that God probably exists? Or does a kind of belief in and confidence that exists in religion, is that a unique form of confidence?
Well, I'm made to chuckle by the idea that a religion might contain the idea that God probably exists. That would be a philosopher's claim, not the claim of a cleric, for example, or a devotee of some faith. Nonetheless, in thinking about religion philosophically, one can look at things like the order in the universe and say, well, given that, there's a probability that there is a designer, and then one can argue about whether the designer has to be God. David Hume took on this kind of argument in great detail, and there were responses to Hume, and of course, many defenses.
Now, the one of the traditions that you work in is a tradition known by philosophers as the analytic tradition, where you spend a lot of time focusing on language and distinctions and trying to define terms and looking at how these terms differ in different contexts. And that made me wonder, is the language of religion is it a different language than, say, the language of politics or the language of everyday life? When we say the word commitment in a religious context or belief in a religious context, are we changing the meanings in a significant way than we use it in other contexts? Or is it the same sort of ideas, maybe with varying degrees of power or discipline?
There are plenty of terms that have special uses or metaphorical uses in religious contexts and different uses in everyday contexts. So when religious people talk about belief, they're often talking about belief in God or belief that God is, say, loving. But not all uses of belief in religious contexts are special like that. Some of them are quite ordinary. Then there is the term faith, which has a number of uses in and outside religion. I've looked at things of that sort, and it's appropriate that philosophers look at both sides, at the internal vocabulary among religious people who are under study and outside. And each domain of discourse can illuminate the other in some cases.
So in a sense, by looking at the religious meaning of faith, we from within a particular tradition, say Catholicism, we might learn a little bit more about what scientists might mean by faith or what a husband or wife might mean about faith and vice versa.
We might. I wouldn't close that issue. I don't have any particular comment on that. I can say this. It's very common in religious traditions for faith in or faith that to be taken to involve a high level of confidence and what could be called unqualifiedly believing. But there are also uses of faith in which it's closer to hope, though stronger. So faith that God is loving might be like trusting that God is loving. And you might think of a secular example that's not inappropriate. You might have faith that someone will survive cancer surgery, where you trust that it's so, but you wouldn't just say you believe so. the probability is, in your view, a little low for that, and yet there's more than hope.
So what then does the word faith give us that, say, hope would not?
Well, if you hope for something, you can believe it's extremely improbable. Faith carries a higher level of conviction than that. Moreover, if you have faith that something's so, you have to have, I think, a positive attitude toward its being so. You could hope that something's so and be ashamed that you are so hoping.
I'm not sure I follow that.
Well, you could hope for another drink when you judge you oughtn't to have one, for example. So hope can be opposed to your best judgment in a way I think faith can't be.
Oh, that's
it. Reflects something more holistic about you and more positive.
That's interesting. So hope can be, even in an extreme sense, some kind of self-destructive nature. I hope my drug dealer is on the corner today so that I can find him or her.
But that is a possibility.
But faith is inherently positive and optimistic?
Well, certainly religious faith,
right,
implies having a positive attitude toward the state of affairs you have faith about. And I think that that's generally true of faith, and that you'd say of the addict that there's hope there, but not faith. Now, the addict might say there's faith, but that would be deluded.
And
whereas the addict wouldn't be deluded in attributing hope to the, kind of stance.
Is this because faith, at least in, let's say, the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, that faith is resting on an all-loving, all-good God?
Well, you're putting it metaphysically. You can have faith in secular contexts and independently of metaphysical considerations. I'm thinking it's a little more like this. Faith goes with trust, and trust goes with what we cherish or are feeling positive about. So that's more the connection that operates in and outside religious contexts.
Huh. And so trust is also an inherently positive term.
Well, if you say, I trust that she'll make it through surgery, you're certainly expressing a positive attitude about its happening. You can say, I trust that sarcastically, when you want to say something that draws people up. But usually, trust implies a positive evaluation of the person trusted or the thing you trust to be the case. There may be some exceptions, but that's the general pattern.
All right, let's take a step back, because we're already seeing these similarities between religious and secular terms, but also focusing on the differences. When you talk about religion, what do you mean? Is it possible to define what a religion is?
You know, I hope you'll give me a moment just to indicate some considerations drawn from William Alston's work regarding what counts as a religion. And what I want to do is just list some criteria briefly.
Okay.
And a criterion is something important to understanding the phenomenon, but it doesn't give you a sufficient condition, and it doesn't even give you a strictly necessary condition. So you have to look at this as a whole. You have appropriately internalized belief in one or more supernatural beings. So you could have polytheism. Two, observance of a distinction between sacred and profane objects. Three, ritual acts focused on the object. Four, a moral code believed to be sanctioned by the god or gods. That's very important, the moral side, right? Five, religious feelings, awe, mystery, and so on, that tend to be aroused by the sacred objects and during rituals. Six, prayer and other communicative forms. So hymns are included there. Poetry is included. Seven, a world view, something I've already mentioned, according the individual a significant place in the universe. Eight, a more or less comprehensive organization of life based on the world view. And finally, a social organization bound together by these things. That might be a congregation. So you have all these elements, and the great Western religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, have all of these elements. but they're non-theistic religions that don't have them all, but they have a lot of them, and that's one reason we call them religions. So the notion of a religion is vague, and ineliminable vagueness faces us when we try to talk about, say, religion and politics. So I think we do well to take important, undisputed cases of religions and talk about those. The definition problem is separate, and we don't have to come up with a simple, sharp definition in order to talk about the subject matter adequately.
I'll make sure that that list gets on our website so our listeners can look at it more closely. Are you suggesting that defining religion is more of an art than a science, that there's an approximate ambiguity to steal a line from the Supreme Court?
Well, I don't think there's ambiguity, but vagueness, which is different. Where you have ambiguity, you might have two or more meanings and you can't tell which one is intended. With vagueness, it's a matter of there being borderline cases versus central cases. And I would say it's a challenge for philosophical explication, but I think we're up to it. The point is, you don't always succeed best philosophically in understanding something when you come up with a crisp definition. That doesn't always work. But there's an awful lot that can be said that applies to the phenomenon.
So this is really interesting. So instead of starting with a definition and seeing which religions meet this definition, we look at those things that we regard as undisputably religion, and we say, what do we learn from those, and what are like cases? What are things that are similar in important, not always exactly the same or not in all ways, but what are similar important ways? So we're starting from an established understanding, and then we're extracting from that.
Sure. You're drawing a contrast between going from the level of abstract definition to the ground level, and on the other hand, starting with the ground level and using intuitive cases that are recognized as cases of the phenomenon, and then going to a definition. And my view would be you've got to go in both directions. You can't just define in the abstract. You can't just theorize about cases without any generalization at all. So we're really looking in both directions here.
When we get back from the break, I want to talk a little bit more about this, and I want to talk about the relationship between good reasons and bad reasons and how we can start thinking about making decisions in a religious context. But first, we are going to take a break. You're listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Robert Audi on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussion in Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Robert Audi about religious commitment and trying to make sense of what religion is and how it relates to reasons and ideas. And I think about my own history with religion, both in terms of my personal struggle, I'll be honest, with what it means to be Jewish and living a Jewish life and when I do want to live it and when I don't. But I also think about my experience growing up when I was young, I took jujitsu for a few years, and I took it in New York City, where I grew up, and I took it in the basement of a Buddhist temple. And the fact that it was in a Buddhist temple gave me a very different experience of jujitsu than my daughter has of taking taekwondo, where she does in Grand Forks, in a strip mall. And I don't know that in the end it matters. I stopped at green belt. She's already a black belt at 10. Her teacher is an incredibly wonderful teacher, one of the best teachers of young people I've ever encountered. We're thrilled. But there is a decontextualization. There is a sense that her taekwondo is not connected to a history that I had. And one of the things that are the deepest and most important things about religion to me is the history that it brings with. And so, Robert, I want to ask you, you spent a significant part of your career at the University of Nebraska, and then you moved to the University of Notre Dame, which is known for its Catholic identity. It's very explicit about its Catholic mission, although its faculty is very diverse. Did your thinking about religion change at all from going to from being at a secular public institution to being at a more religiously oriented private institution?
Well, religion, and certainly including the philosophy of religion, is a major subject at the University of Notre Dame, which I think is really the leading institution worldwide for philosophy of religion. So I learned a great deal more about philosophy of religion and more about religion itself. I don't know that there was a dramatic personal change for me. I'd been thinking about the philosophy of religion for years and interacting with a number of leading people in the field, including people at Notre Dame. But Notre Dame encourages all sorts of views on the topics that concern it, and that certainly applies to religion.
Is religion, and there's the sense amongst people, particularly who are critical of religion, that religion is inherently conservative. Does it have to be? Is there, or can religion be progressive in the variety of the senses of the term?
Well, I think that there are things religions seek to conserve, but that doesn't make them conservative overall. And if you think about what is required by the commandment to love one's neighbor, which is in the Old Testament as well as the New, you realize that all sorts of innovation is called for in a world like this. If we really care about refugees and the poor and the sick. So also in politics, you find the religious divide into conservative and liberal, much as other groups do. And many who are very deeply religious are also very liberal.
Right. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, comes to mind. I often tell my students that there's no such thing as Judaism, there's no such thing as Islam, there's no such thing as Christianity. They're Judaisms, Islams, and Christianities, right? Every religion has its own sphere of denominations, from the liberal or conservative. If you get a religion that is very wide on that spectrum, let's say Reconstructionist Jews were very, very far to the left by American political standards, and ultra-Orthodox right-wing Jews. What makes those two groups the same religion? What gives a religion its unity when there's so many different denominational differences?
Well, I was suggesting to you that you could have neighbor love as central and get different interpretations of what it requires. You can also get different interpretations of divine command and, of course, different interpretations of any scripture. So even when a scripture has very high authority in a religion, there may not be an undisputed interpretation of even the fairly clear parts of it. But it does, the scripture does, exercise a unifying influence. And there will be areas of broad agreement, even if there are plenty of differences. So I think there are unifying forces scripturally, historically, sometimes in terms of common experience. But there's plenty of room to differ. And broadly, by the way, there are going to be differences about what it takes to achieve human flourishing, which practically any religion thinks we ought to emphasize as a goal.
Explain a little bit more what you mean by human flourishing.
Well, we human beings have many capacities: intellectual, aesthetic, athletic, social. And generally, though there are differences in ideals for the development of these capacities, there are commonalities. So I think we believe in bringing up children so they can exercise these capacities. And some religions emphasize this more than others. I don't want to go into detailed comparisons here, but I think this will be obvious. But, you know, the concern for children and their well-being is common to religions, and we hope that the benefits of what has been learned in human history will flow into the conception of human flourishing available in and outside religion.
So some religions, say, will prioritize literacy, and another religion will prioritize mental stability, and another religion will prioritize selflessness. And these are all aspects of human flourishing that allow religions to give a picture of what it means not only to be a good person, but what it also means to be a full person. Is that right?
One could argue for that. You know, we could differ about some of the details, but that's a reasonable perspective.
And is that notion of how one wants to live or how one should live or how one gets the fullness of the human experience, is that one of the central attractiveness? That's not a real word, but is that one of the things that attracts people to religion? Because and the reason why I ask this is that there are some people who would suggest, and I don't necessarily think this is fair in many cases, although it's fair in some cases, that people are attracted to religion because they want to be told what to do. That they want to be ordered around, or that they want other people to make decisions for them. When, especially in popular culture, when people talk about cults as opposed to more mainstream religions, there's this sense.
I'm afraid there are people who meet that description. Educated people generally do not, and one should not want to be told what to do, but one should want serious discussion and a good statement of various ideals. So you can tell that I believe in natural reason, which in many religious traditions is taken to be a gift of God. And it seems to me that natural reason should be used in interpreting scripture and in interpreting clerical pronouncements about divine command. So although religion can be a source of security and guidance, it shouldn't be leaned on thoughtlessly.
In a minute, I want to ask you about natural reason, and I want to have a little conversation about that so that our listeners can have a better sense of the very complex sentence that you just uttered. But I want to push you on something and ask you, you just said you don't believe that people should be told what to do. Is that a secular position? Is that a modern liberal position that's built on this notion of individual autonomy? Or is that or are there religions that are built on the idea that no, you should not be told what to do? You have to find it yourself.
Well, remember, I didn't quite say no one should be told what to do. It's that in general, one shouldn't be looking to be told what to do as opposed to figuring out what to do, exercising autonomy. So looking for guidance is one thing, but we ought to make rational decisions about living our lives. Now, I'm not talking about children. Children do need to be told what to do within certain limits.
So this notion of guidance goes back to this comment that we talked about earlier, that there's an art to this, that it's not a very strict checklist and a very strict definition. And so for an autonomous person to seek religious guidance, they should get suggestions, they should get role models, they should have scriptures to consider. But ultimately, in a general sense, people should come to these commitments themselves.
We are responsible for what we do. And I think that we're responsible even when we're following directives. And so, given our capacity to use reason, I think we should make judgments about what we ought to do and learn from various sources. So it's one thing to recognize authorities as having earned some credibility through what they have themselves shown us or learned and exhibited, but we still have to make judgments, and we're responsible for what we do.
So this connects back to what I promised we would talk about, this notion of natural reason and divine command. By divine command, you mean the commands of God, either as it comes directly for some prophets or through the scriptures, through the Quran, through the books of Leviticus, through the Gospels. These assertions that God makes, these or that God's representative makes, that tell us the rules, the laws, the expectations. But then there's this thing called natural reason, which allows us to interpret them. What is natural reason?
Well, the most simple case is that of deductive rationality. So you have to reject explicit contradictions. There's something wrong with asserting one and with trying to believe one. And there are obviously valid arguments, obviously invalid arguments, and one should seek to avoid using or depending on invalid arguments. Now, when it comes to degrees of probability, the matter is more complicated. And here, it's crucial that we use evidence from perception. And so the evidence of the senses generally is very highly respected. And coming over to the practical domain, it seems to me quite obvious that one should avoid gratuitous suffering. You shouldn't just stick your hand in a fire. That really isn't controversial. It's a universal standard. There are exceptions in behavior that suggest some people are disturbed, but in general, we regard people as disturbed who don't avoid pain. The matter of the value of enjoyable experiences, which are taken to be elements in human flourishing, is trickier because one can enjoy the wrong sort of thing, such as brutalizing others. But I think natural reason does apply in ethical matters as well as in matters having to do with characteristics of nature.
So you're relying on two terms that I know when I first started studying philosophy was an important distinction that I ended up understanding, and that's this distinction between reason and rationality. Reason is the natural capacity we have to make judgments, to use logic, to infer consequences. It's in large sense a capacity. But rationality, that kind of describes our ability
right.
to determine whether something contradicts itself, right?
Well, minimum responsiveness to reason and reasons. So if you've got rationality, you are responding to reasons, broadly speaking. You may not be expert at it, but the minimum case is responsiveness to reasons. And I've given you some indication what the basic kinds of reasons are. They come certainly from perception, and they come from the domain of logic.
So a person is irrational if they understand that doing something is going to cause them extreme pain with no good reason, no good consequence. They're not making some kind of sacrifice, but they do it anyway, and they're even surprised that the pain happens, even though they understood that the pain was going to happen if they did it.
That sounds like a case of irrationality, all right. Seeking pain gratuitously.
And so why is religion so frequently associated with the irrational when it presumes I would think that religion presumes a kind of rationality because it demands that its adherents follow through on things in expected ways, for expected consequences, and to adjust to situations. I mean, so is it the mysticism? Is it the superstition? Let me rephrase the question.
Yes, I see what you're asking. I think you're wondering, you know, what it is that leads to the view that a religious commitment is irrational, and one thing that leads to it is the impression that there are no probabilistic grounds for theism. So it's usually against theistic religions that this kind of view is brought, right? That's the target normally. There's also the problem of evil, and there are certain other kinds of problems. And philosophers of religion have responded to these things, I think, quite well. And I don't think the result is that everybody rational who gets information about the issues must be a theist, but there are plenty of ways to have a grip on the issues. and to have a life experience that makes a religious commitment, even of a theistic kind, rational.
Okay, so you mentioned the problem of evil, and the problem of evil is basically, at least in one form, God is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. And if God were all of these things, why is there evil in the world? Why is there suffering? And a person who is skeptical of religion would say, this is proof that there is no God, or this is evidence that there is no God, because, or at least that God isn't all-good or all-knowing or all-powerful. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I wonder if you'd elaborate just a little bit on why, in the face of the problem of evil, these people are wrong and that it isn't irrational to hold religious beliefs.
Well,
I mean, I know that's a hard question.
Yeah. Well, look, the simplest thing to say is you have to understand that there's moral evil and there's natural evil, and these have to be viewed differently. And moral evil is a matter of wrongdoing. And the next thing you have to ask is whether wrongdoing involves the misuse of free will, and you have to ask whether a God who is loving would create beings like us with free will and bring it about that we never misuse free will. That would seem manipulative. You can also ask whether all three of the attributes you mentioned are really essential. There are plenty of theologians who think, well, perfect goodness and omniscience, all-knowingness, but omnipotence is not an essential attribute. Without that, you don't get the problem in the acute form in which you mentioned it. So that's just an example. There's a huge amount more to say.
And given that, I'm going to ask you a variation of the very first question I asked, because I know that there are people who are listening now who are thinking, well, in that sentence, he talked about free will. He talked about omnipotence. He talked about all these things. And I don't know what any of that stuff means, or I sort of know what it means, and I sort of don't. And it feels like in order to question religion, I have to know all of this stuff. I have to know it all. It's the problem of the one and the many, right? I have to know everything in order to question anything. And so let me ask you a version of the first question I asked, which is, how is a person who is enamored with the idea of philosophy of religion, how is a person who wants to start taking this intellectual approach to studying religion and its foundations, how does one negotiate all the stuff that they don't know to start asking the kind of questions that we're asking today?
Well, I think we're making a start right here, but you're bringing out that you can't approach a complicated matter like this without some background. And all over the country, we offer introductory courses in philosophy and in philosophy of religion in many places that help with this. There's also a lot that can be read, and there are some things that are pretty elementary. But really, you do have to commit yourself to understanding what a religion is, what the range of religious views is, and what the arguments pro and con are. And then there's also the matter of experience. What is your life actually like? Are there any experiences that you cannot readily explain in terms of the usual causes and effects? So some lives have things like that, religious experiences, and others do not. That's another variable here.
There are people who are going to be skeptical of the interpretation of personal experience in the sense, not just when it comes to conversions, but I'm thinking of the sports star who thanks God, says, you know, God is to get credit for catching the touchdown, but always blames himself for missing the pass. How do we deal with the selectivity of interpreting experience? Is that just human beings? Is it idiosyncratic? Is there an inherent inconsistency and people get to filter their fine meaning however they want? Or are there established standards for what counts as a good reason for believing?
I think you're getting at the question whether anyone has experiences that are best explained in terms of supernatural factors. Now, I don't see a knockdown argument from any experience I've heard described to the conclusion that it is an experience of something supernatural. But to say that is not to say that supernatural causal factors are an impossibility. And I think a person has to be critical, but not necessarily heavily skeptical, in understanding what one's experience means. Note, too, that a religious experience can be one that would not occur were this not a world under God. It doesn't have to be an experience of God. So there are a number of ways to look at experiences that are of an extraordinary kind.
Why don't you talk a little bit more about the last comment, how it doesn't have to be an experience of God? Because I'm not, 'cause that's it's a subtle point, and I think it's an important one.
Yes. Look, there are experiences that are had in contexts where love between persons is very powerful and deeply felt. There are experiences that come through in music and art that seem to transcend just the aesthetic. Now, why are there those experiences? What do they mean regarding the ultimate nature of reality? One could simply seek a psychological explanation, but is it obvious that that's the only explanation there is? And if there is a psychological explanation, does its very existence suggest that there can't be a religiously significant origin of the natural pattern where the psychological explanation applies?
So we're talking a little bit about experiences that are, some would call it transcendent, that take us out of our individual place and our individual moment, and also what other philosophers and religious theorists will call the sublime, something that is not just beautiful but powerful and connects us to the largeness of the universe. And so are you suggesting that transcendent experiences or experiences of the sublime can have religious content even if they're not directly connected to God?
I think that's worth exploring, and that there may be a good case for that. Certainly experiences of the sublime are among the kinds I was talking about.
It's funny. I was listening, of all things, to a live Allman Brothers album yesterday, and there was a moment where I was just listening to this extended guitar solo, and I completely succumbed to the music. Now, when we think about transcendent music or music that are sublime, we tend to think of Bach, you know, and other religiously motivated music. But if what you're suggesting is true, then at least it's plausible to think that I could have that experience listening to a quote-unquote purely secular music because it would allow me to reach into something deeper.
That much seems plausible to me.
If that's the case, then how do we maintain the distinction that you brought up in your list from William Alston earlier of the distinction between the secular and the divine? Does that mean that or the secular and the sacred? Does that mean that it's entirely perspectival, that I get to decide or the clergy get to decide whether it's secular or not? Or is it more along sort of an enlightened tradition where it's how you choose to view? I guess the question I'm asking is the distinction between the sacred and the secular an artifact? Is it a human creation? Is it the way we limit or is it just what we tend to focus on, and anything can be either secular or sacred depending on how we conceive it? Or is that a matter for individual religions to decide?
Well, individual religions will posit certain kinds of objects or relations as sacred, and persons may be taken to be sacred. If you take the term sacred at the highest level, it will entail some version of theism, it seems to me. It certainly suggests a need for a reverential attitude. But taking off from that, you could say that what's sacred merits a reverential attitude, and that's all we need. And the purely secular needn't be sacred in that sense, and characteristically isn't.
Some other voices are talking in the back of my head, and some questions that people have asked in anticipation of the show. And so, given that we're talking about this, the secular and the sacred, there are people who claim that atheism is itself a religion. Do you think that that's a fair claim?
Well, I think that it can involve a kind of religious claim if it countenances there being God and denies that God actually exists. But I don't think atheism meets a number of the criteria that I mentioned as indicating a religion. So it would be a very full-blooded atheism with a lot more than what the term usually carries that would qualify as a religion. So I'm inclined to think it's not plausible to call atheism as such a religion.
So atheism is a position about the existence or the non-existence of God, but in terms of the other things that it provides, the rituals that it provides, the worldviews that it provides, it's not robust enough.
Yes, yes. Mere atheism doesn't provide a worldview. It's negative.
Okay, so now people are going to follow up and ask, well, but doesn't, say, science follow up with that view?
And now we're talking about secular humanism, I think.
Right.
And it's a better question whether secular humanism is a religion. And I'd say it could be religious in involving reverential attitudes, but I wouldn't call it a religion.
Now, you've worked quite a bit in epistemology as well, which is the study of knowledge, how we know things, what the limits of knowledge are. Is religious epistemology a different animal, to use a metaphor, than non-religious epistemology? Is how we know things in religious context, mm-hmm. are the criteria different or
– I really think of it as epistemology applied to the subject matter of religion. So I don't think of it as different. It's a subfield of epistemology. So in a way, the phrase the epistemology of religion is a better phrase.
And does that preclude I don't want to get too inside baseball here, but so an empiricist, someone like John Locke or David Hume, is going to argue that all of our knowledge comes from our sense experience. And you mentioned this much earlier in the show, that we use our experiences to help supply information to our natural reason. Yet religion presumes that there are things going on that is inaccessible to our senses. So is it possible to have a purely empiricist?
Well, there are two things to say here at least. One is that empiricism is a rather narrow view, and it seems to me that we do have knowledge, including some in logic and pure mathematics, that is not based on perception or based on experience in the sense Hume had in mind, for example, Hume. Now, reason operates in normative matters, for example, and it's not clear to me that it's a matter of anything empirical that there is reason to avoid causing pain to oneself for no further reason, just seeking pain for its own sake, for instance. So reason has some normative dimensions that are not congenial to empiricism. So they're not contra-experiential. They don't go against experience, but the kind of experience that's involved is not mainly a matter of perception.
So to impose value or to say that causing pain on someone is bad as opposed to good, this is something that we need more than our senses to figure out. We need a kind of reason. We need a kind of cognitive reflection. We need a variety of other things to come to these conclusions, because our experience can't necessarily give us a sense of distinguishing between good and bad.
Well, I want to be careful here. You need experience to get the concepts of pleasure and pain and of good and bad. But you aren't relying on sense experience to know that it's irrational to seek pain for its own sake, the way you're relying on sense experience to know the contents of the room you're in, or ultimately to know how a chemical reaction is going to go. So I think empiricism is simply too narrow. It doesn't account fully for human reason.
Okay, so I want to ask, I want to shift the discussion a little bit and ask the main question of the episode, at least as I had originally framed it. And then, with your permission, I want to move away from this kind of discussion and talk a little bit about political philosophy and its connection to religion. But before that, what exactly does the word commitment mean when we talk about religious commitment? And are there criteria for what is a legitimate commitment, what it means when you are committed and when you are not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I talked in my book, Rationality and Religious Commitment, about a lot of dimensions of religious commitment. So there's the intellectual commitment, which we've talked about a good deal. But characteristically, there's a moral commitment that involves, for instance, caring about people's well-being. So a full-scale religious commitment in a full-blooded religion, like Christianity, Judaism, just take the biblical religions, has an ethic, and it even has much concerning the aesthetic in life and much concerning emotion, what counts as an appropriate way to feel, where love is one key example. So commitment involves both the cognitive intellectual side and the behavioral moral side and the aesthetic emotional side.
So commitment is really a holistic idea, something that involves not just our actions but our attitudes, our self-identity. It really is I want to find a synonym for commitment and I can't, but it really is committing our whole being in a religious sense.
Well, a religious commitment is very wide. It is holistic. You could talk about a person committed to other things as well, right? So somebody might have scientific commitments that are pretty wide-ranging as well as religious commitments. And I've argued these things can go together.
So
and what I've done is to suggest that too much discussion about the rationality of religion has focused on the cognitive intellectual side of religious commitment. And there hasn't been enough attention to the moral side and the aesthetic emotional side. And there's a political element as well for many religions, though it's broad. It may in some cases be very specific, but you know, religion as such doesn't have very specific political commitments. When you get to a particular religion, you may get some.
So am I hearing you right when you're suggesting that to a certain extent part of the mistake that we make when we talk about religion is we're trying to explain religion using scientific or secular standards, and that since those focus on cognitive, intellectual, logical, purely rational criteria, that that's not going to get the other parts of religion, which are moral, which are aesthetic, which are emotional, which have these other aspects of human experience, that at least some areas of science, what philosophers will call positivism in some contexts, they just don't have the mechanisms to address. And so it's a mistake. Religion is always going to fail by a purely scientific standard, in the same way I suspect that science is going to fail by a purely religious standard.
Well, I don't say that science fails by a religious standard. It simply is non-religious, and I think religion is non-scientific, but it isn't unscientific. And I would say that there's nothing wrong with applying intellectual standards that come from the use of natural reason to the appraisal of many elements in religion, but let's remember that moral truths are non-scientific. They're not unscientific. They don't go against anything scientific. But they're not matters of scientific theory, on my view and on many views.
So by non-scientific and unscientific, you're making the distinction between – it's not that they're contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
It's that
– Of science, yeah.
Of science. It's mm-hmm. just that there's something else, and they can be completely compatible because you can be a moral person and a scientist at the same time, even if you don't use the scientific standards and criteria to explain and justify your morality.
That's right, and you could, alas, be quite immoral and be very scientific.
And certainly history is full of both examples, right?
Right.
So with that in mind, I want to shift the discussion just a little bit to social and political philosophy because
right.
You've done a fair amount of work on the separation of church and state.
Right.
And I know that there are people who are listening, especially to this last part of the conversation, who will say, but the problem is that these religions are trying to limit what we can talk about in science, and they're rejecting science, and they reject evolution, and they do all this kind of stuff, and this then mm-hmm. leads to questions of freedom of speech and freedom of
sure.
inquiry and all that sort of stuff. And so let me ask again a version of that same first question. How do we start talking about the separation of church and state to reevaluate, as you do, what that might look like and how to justify such a separation? Where do we begin?
Right. Let's talk about democratic societies. And I think there's wide agreement that they should separate church and state. Our British English cousins are an exception, but they have an established church, but their establishment is thin and civil liberty runs high there. But it's better to have the American separation, I maintain, and that protects religion as well as the state. So take that, which is desirable for religious liberty, and think about now the ethics of citizenship and go to an issue like religious accommodation in the public schools. Are we unreasonable in allowing classes to be missed for religious reasons? Well, it's very tricky to make exceptions for religious commitments and not for other kinds of commitments. And in dealing with this very difficult issue, I've indicated that one has to find a way to treat non-religious citizens equally. And so it's possible there will be a non-religious point of view that figures so importantly in the life of a non-religious citizen that that person should have an excuse for missing class, as the religious person should. Now, historically and in terms of the pattern of American life, it's for religious reasons that people feel they must have observances that conflict with classes. People who are devotees of sports or the arts don't feel that way, but let's remember that even devotees of sports and the arts generally don't have their life governed by their commitments to sports or the arts to the extent that people have their lives governed by their religious commitments. So there is a kind of even-handedness possible in a democracy that goes with a good deal of religious accommodation.
You know, it's funny that you mention that because as you're talking, I'm thinking about college athletes. University of North Dakota is a Division I school. Notre Dame mm-hmm, is mm-hmm. as well.
Yep,
and
yep.
we continually allow student athletes to miss classes for road games and things like that. And so you're making actually – and it had never occurred to me before, but you're making a really nice analogy by saying, look, if we are going to allow people to take time away from school because religious commitment is so important, that's fine as long as when there are similar levels of commitment,
sure.
we do that. And so the analogy is actually student athletes, even though some people talk about being fans, you know, the Boston Red Sox are a religion, but that's just that's hyperbole. That's very interesting. And so what you're doing in a sense is you're prioritizing you're prioritizing the equality.
Yes, equality before the law is crucial,
right.
And ethics is basically egalitarian regarding moral status. So in response to the question, why is religion special, I've argued that historically and contingently it is special because of the way it figures in lives, but it's possible that there be something else that is non-religious and is as special to the devotees of it as religion is for the religious. In that case, we have to make accommodations. And you're right to bring up the accommodation for sports. North Dakota has, athletics built into its curriculum, and so exceptions are provided for. Notre Dame has Christianity built into its curriculum, and so exceptions are provided for. Well, that is within reason in a democratic society, and it's all within a broadly egalitarian structure.
It's really interesting. So religion is special because historically, that's just where we ended up.
But no, it's not that contingent, but it is contingently special in the sense that it's not impossible that something else play a similar role in the life of people whose flourishing is equally a concern of government. That's the idea.
So for church and state to remain separate, which you believe, then we have to recognize that there are things that may take the that may have as much intense commitment as religion, and we have to make a space for that. We have to remain this is a loaded term for political philosophers, but we have to remain neutral in the sense that we're not going to prioritize religion over sports other than to say it's the intensity of the personal commitment and the holism of the personal commitment that allows us to make the decision, not the content, not the fact that it is religion as opposed to sports.
That's roughly correct. So we respect people and their deepest commitments and what they devote their lives to. There are limits. We don't protect violence, and we should not protect religiously or otherwise motivated mutilations of human beings. So there are limits. But democracy should not decide what it is that's central in your life as long as you live within civilized limits. So accommodations have to be made. Now, there are practical considerations. So, for example, if certain women working in a factory want to wear burqas and they might get caught in machines and caused serious injury, well, then that's an accommodation that does not make sense in terms of the larger values that are defensible by natural reason.
You don't want to endanger your workers in any extreme way.
For example.
Right. Yeah. And suppose someone comes along and says that risk is worth it to announce one's religious commitment or to follow the law under the Quran. How do you respond to someone who says, but I'm willing to take that risk?
Well, if it's just a risk to the person, that's one thing. But typically there are many, many reverberations. So, there's the matter of who pays for the injury when it occurs and what work is disrupted for other people if there's blood all over the place. So you can't just say you're willing to take the risk as though no one else were involved when we're in a system where other people have to pick up the pieces.
And that leads to the final question, which also comes out of the political philosophical tradition, particularly the liberal tradition, which is, and I'll explain the question to my readers, to my listeners, is religion private? And what I mean by that is philosophers like John Rawls have argued that there are these things that are public consideration that the government has to take positions on, that the government has to advocate for, and then there are these private things that we have to be free to pursue, but they are our own decisions, and they're about what we control in our own lives, and the government cannot abridge or establish these notions. And so for Rawls, famously, religion is purely private. And so I guess the question, and this is both from a political philosopher sense, but also the stuff that we've been talking about and what you've learned from philosophy of religion, do you think that religion is a private endeavor or is it of more public concern?
Well, I think, by the way, you're referring to Rorty or thinking of Rorty rather than Rawls on privatization And I have not suggested that religion should be privatized and never expressed in the public sphere, nor have I ever suggested restrictions on freedom of speech. What I have suggested that has given some people the impression that I've wanted to privatize religion is this, that in lawmaking, where one is supporting laws or public policies that would restrict human behavior, which is, of course, most of them, one should have adequate secular reason, and that's natural reason. It doesn't depend on religion. So, for instance, if you want to outlaw assisted suicide, your reason should be something like this. Legalization will be used to exploit the poor. That might be, with enough evidence, an adequate non-religious reason. If your reason is only God gives life and only God should take it, that's not an appropriate reason for restricting the behavior of people who aren't theists or who are theists, and there are many, who think God should allow us to determine our manner of dying as well as our manner of living. So that, to me, is not at all anti-religious. It simply suggests that natural reason, as readily conceivable as a gift of God, can direct political decision when coercion is at stake, as it often is.
So laws, policies have to have reasons that are accessible to all, that are secular, and that this doesn't stop religious folks from making these arguments as well, because they would supplement their position. So, for example, a religious person who thinks that euthanasia or assisted suicide is against the law of God could also say that it exploits the poor.
Correct. It might not be good politics to do that, but that should be available under freedom of expression, and it might be required for sincerity.
So, in closing, is there anything that you would recommend? I found your book, Religious Commitment, Secular Reason, very accessible. I think that our listeners would really be able to follow it well. I felt that Rationality and Religious Commitment was a little more technical, and people would have to have a little more background and experience with the kind of distinction making that professional philosophers make. What would you recommend, either by yourself or someone else, that would give someone the start to thinking philosophically about religion?
Well, there's a good deal in my more recent book, Democratic Authority and the Separation of Church and State, Oxford University Press, that might be pretty accessible for people interested in all this. And there are very good textbooks in the philosophy of religion, if it's that rather than the religion and politics side that people are most interested in. I'm not sure where I would start. There are an awful lot of good things, but I highly recommend university courses taught by good people that introduce philosophy and introduce philosophy of religion. Philosophy is a very exciting subject for lots of people.
And there is now also a whole industry of YouTube videos and other things that are short or longer introductions to all of these topics. I will make sure that we have links to your work and to the criteria that you articulated earlier on our web page. Robert Audi, thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Robert Audi on What is Religious Commitment? With Why Philosophical Discussion of Everyday Life. And I'll be back right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We've been talking with Robert Audi about religious commitment. And as is often the case with some of the more difficult issues, we spend a lot of time talking about language, talking about words, making distinctions between this kind of commitment and this kind of commitment and this kind of reason and that kind of reason. And we're trying to make sense of a really big topic, a topic that involves history, sociology, psychology, and also a topic that involves your personal experience. You, as a listener, have religious experiences. They might not be positive, although they often are, but you have your own religious experience. And the difficulty that anyone who talks about religion faces is that whatever they talk about has to connect to your personal experience. It has to ring true to you. The advantage of philosophy of religion is that it doesn't talk about necessarily a particular religion. It can, but it doesn't have to. And it doesn't necessarily talk about a particular scripture or even a particular moral code. It asks what the structures of religion ought to be. It asks what the limits of religion ought to be. It asks what the relationship to religion and other things ought to be. And this means it gets abstract very quickly. This is the problem of the public philosopher. The problem of the public philosopher is, how do you take these abstract ideas, how do you take these terminological disputes and make them as accessible as possible to as large an audience as possible? I think that a lot of people are going to have part of the show that they're going to understand intuitively and other parts of the show that they may want to go back to and listen to again. And that's fine. That's great, because the more we think about it, the more we internalize it. But here's the point. Religion is one way that we get philosophical commitments into our lives. Religion is one way that we get these abstract ideas, these moral ideas, these ideas about knowledge, these ideas about how the universe is really constructed. Religion is one way that we get fed these ideas from birth, through our literature, from our parents, from the television shows we watch, from the music we listen to. Religion is one important way that these philosophical ideas come to us. And so the question then becomes, how do we experience them critically, not as a knee-jerk political reaction, but as a thoughtful, critical person who wants to value the experience while still remaining skeptical when it's appropriate? This is what philosophy of religion does, and this is what a philosophical commitment looks like in the face of a religious commitment. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower. –